the fact that on his very first day in office, Trump attacked birthright citizenship makes it clear what he is trying to do. It's part of a wider strategy to deter immigration, really deter immigration of non-white people, let's be very honest, and reshape U.S. demographic landscape. So that's what we're talking about. And it did come up in a lot of ways in today's oral argument.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is Justice by Design. You know, when I think about justice, I can't think of any other more fundamental truth than people born on U.S. soil, just like I was and generations of people before me, are American. But unfortunately, it took some in my previous generation, some of my ancestors, to go to the Supreme Court to have that affirmatively declared, as others have. And I think back to 127 years ago, a Supreme Court case which really laid out a core tenet of what it was meant to be an American. There was a man who was born in San Francisco. His parents left and returned to their country of origin because they could not receive citizenship in America. So once, when he went to visit them and tried to return to the U.S., he was denied reentry. What was the basis? A claim that he was not a citizen because his parents aren't. And his case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled no, he absolutely is a citizen because he was born in San Francisco. That man, Juan Kim Ark, his name has now become synonymous with the Supreme Court blessing that foundational principle that took a constitutional amendment for descendants of enslaved people, and then another Supreme Court case to affirm that that applies to others born in the United States. The Supreme Court is now taking that issue up again, in a way, in deciding about the legality of one of the Trump administration's, President Trump's, executive orders that seeks to strip that birthright citizenship from some children born to Americans, frankly, that he doesn't like. I can't really find another justification for it. He wants to pick and choose who is an American. And the question is, what will the Supreme Court rule? And to help me break this down, and that's why I'm so happy to be joined by my guest, Manjusha Kulkarni, who is co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate, to talk about the impact of this executive order, the stakes of this Supreme Court case, and what it means particularly to AAPI folks here in the United States. Manju, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Kim. It's a real honor and privilege for me.
So before we get started, I always ask my guests to take a couple minutes to introduce themselves. So tell us who you are and what you do there at Stop AAPI Hate.
Great. So I, as you mentioned, am one of the co-founders. We started the organization, the coalition, really, in March of 2020, after we began to see the reemergence of anti-Asian hate. It's unfortunately not a new thing, just like anti-Blackness, just like other forms of racism against people of color. But what we saw was, even before COVID hit our shores, there were cases of anti-Asian hate. And here in Los Angeles, a 12-year-old boy was physically attacked and verbally assaulted on the schoolyard. Another kid came up to him and said, "You're a COVID carrier, go back to China." And when he reflexively responded, "I'm not Chinese," he was punched in the face and head 20 times. And all of this happened before there was a single confirmed case of COVID in Southern California. So we knew and understood that the racism was more virulent, in its spread than even the virus itself. I've been working in the area of civil rights for over 20 years. I actually started my career right after college at the Southern Poverty Law Center, worked over the summers during law school at the ACLU in MALDEF. And really, it's all of that work with so many others that kind of culminated in, I think, this movement now since 2020, where we've been able to see and identify not just individual acts of hate, but the way in which racist rhetoric and xenophobic policies hurt our communities. And giving name to that and showing our community members the impacts of their vote, the impacts of those policies on everyday Americans whose roots are in Asia, like myself.
So I want to start off, as we record this conversation, the arguments in that Supreme Court challenge have wrapped up just mere minutes ago. So we're still digesting this, and I'm glad that you are here to help me parse what we heard. The case is, in its current posture, not really about the constitutionality of this attempt to limit birthright citizenship to those who are born to people who are either citizens or have a green card or some other authorization to be in the country. It essentially wants to deny people who are in the country without authorization because they've overstayed a visa or because they're only here short term on vacation or other ways. That is not, as I stated, has not how it has been interpreted heretofore, certainly not in the last 127 years. But this case comes on a posture of the fact that it was a nationwide injunction issued by three trial courts that kept this executive order from going into effect across the country. And the question is whether it is lawful for judges to issue that kind of widespread injunction, whether they have that authority. But it seemed pretty clear to me, Manju, that the justices across the ideological spectrum were not missing the elephant in the room, which is the fact that this seems spurious legally, to say the least. So what was your reaction to the argument?
Well, I agree with everything that you said. You know, while the heart of the case is about the validity and appropriateness of nationwide injunctions, you can't help but realize that this is really about the future of America, right? And that's what birthright citizenship essentially is, right? Do we give a level playing field to all children born in America, or do we make distinctions based on their parents' immigration status? And as you pointed out, heretofore for over, you know, almost 130 years, we have not made that distinction. And, you know, for us in the AAPI community, birthright citizenship is so critical and fundamental to our identities. You know, in your introduction, you mentioned Wong Kim Ark, and he was the one to challenge that because, you know, it had been very sort of narrowly interpreted early on as really only applying to formerly enslaved folks. And the 14th Amendment was the one that really created birthright citizenship, again, to give a level playing field to those born of individuals with different rights and privileges. And, you know, of course, those were enslaved had little to none of those. So what we know and understand from this, and really from the second Trump administration, is this is an effort to tear apart the constitutional promises made to all of us. The fact that on his very first day in office, Trump attacked birthright citizenship makes it clear what he is trying to do. It's part of a wider strategy to deter immigration, really deter immigration of non-white people, let's be very honest, mm-hmm. and reshape U.S. demographic landscape. So that's what we're talking about. And it did come up in a lot of ways in today's oral argument.
Yes. Yes, it did. And I was happy that justices on, like I said, across the ideological spectrum seemed to express skepticism, to say the least, at whether the order will withstand constitutional scrutiny at all. But I want to drill back down to the point that you were making about what it means to be an American. The government is arguing, well, the distinction only applies, to the fact that people born in the United States are automatically citizens, only applies to enslaved and formerly enslaved people. It was not meant to apply any further, which I think I see no such limitation in the constitutional language. But as I was thinking about this before talking to you, the reason that we have a constitution, right? What separates the constitution from laws that are passed by Congress or that are passed by state legislatures is that those are supposed to espouse foundational principles and also set a standard across the board that protects Americans from things like the political winds that blow from one way to another. And throughout the course of our history, there have been many, many instances of administrations appealing to our darkest angels, appearing to some of the worst impulses that I can think of. And a lot of those are involving racism and xenophobia and othering and deciding who gets to be, who gets to carry the mantle of Americanness. Even among people who are unquestionably citizens, there's this been this idea that they have to assimilate, that they have to be as white as possible. And when we're talking about Wong Kim Ark, we can't talk about that without talking about the Chinese Exclusion Act of the 19th century, which is one of the, that was a law that was passed by Congress. And it was one of the most racist things that our nation has ever done. So talk a little bit about that, that we have, In my opinion, a president who wants to act like a king and determine who his royal subjects are. And it's based on, among other things, race. So why is it so important that something like that be constitutionally guarded against?
Great question. So, you know, as you pointed out, what President Trump is trying to do is really recharacterize America and Americans. And we see even just from the decision this past couple of weeks to allow white individuals who are part of the apartheid system, white Afrikaners, to gain refugee status, right? The United States and the world said decades ago that apartheid was morally wrong, was reprehensible, and that it should not be allowed. And so South Africa was able to move beyond that. Now, these fringe ideas that white supremacists have advanced around something called white genocide, which is a fabrication. There's no truth to it. But now that is American policy, and that drives American policy. Sadly, it was not only the Chinese Exclusion Act, but multiple other acts that forbade people outside of Europe from coming to the United States. People don't realize that in 1917, there was another law called the Asiatic Barred Zone Act, which prevented anyone from Asia from coming to the United States. It was literally illegal for people like my family to come to the US until essentially 1965 with the Immigration Act of 1965. And so that too, multiple laws trying to shape America as whites only, right? And thankfully, because of civil rights leaders who didn't rest on their laurels after passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, they demanded that immigration also be equal. And so it was the Immigration Act of 1965 that they advocated for that allowed my own family to come to the United States. I came with my parents in 1971 as a toddler, and my two sisters benefited from birthright citizenship, you know, within a few years. And my own children benefit from birthright citizenship. So it's so important. And, you know, Justice Sotomayor asked a question today that I think is so key to our understanding. What are the implications of what the Trump administration wants to do? Will we be creating, and will the Supreme Court essentially be creating thousands of stateless individuals? Because many other countries also have birthright citizenship. So if the children of immigrants are not U.S. citizens, and imagine in this time of mass deportations, are then deported, where do they go? Because right. they are stateless.
That is such an important point, and I'm glad that you brought it up. One of the things that has frustrated me over the past several months is remembering the widespread absolute horror and outrage at the idea of children being separated from their parents in the deportation process during the first Trump administration. Whereas now, things are happening that are even worse, if you can imagine that possible, than that. And in it certainly includes children. And I too appreciated the question from Justice Sotomayor about stateless children. And also the discussion about how, since many of our federal things like federal benefits, things like Medicaid or healthcare or other, other benefits that are issued through the federal government are done through the states. So, and this is back to the injunction question. If some states say that, if in some states a judge has ruled that this order is unconstitutional, and in other states judges have ruled that it's not, then you will have the weird phenomenon that as a child moves from state to state, their citizenship status changes in a very fundamental way. Just help us understand what the impact will be on the AAPI community if this court does not unequivocally say that a president cannot, by executive fiat, deny children citizenship if they're born on U.S. soil.
The impact is tremendous. We know that almost 2 million Asians have some form of temporary lawful status. And so, and that's really 6 in 10, right, of individuals in the United States with temporary status are Asian. That includes students, that includes H-1B visa holders, that includes individuals with TPS, temporary protected status, who are here after, you know, their countries have been ravished by a, you know, enormous earthquake or tsunami or tornado. And so those individuals, when they have children, we have said those children are American citizens. And I will give you some examples. In the Indian community, we heard after this executive order came out that women were begging their doctors to have C-sections before the date of, I believe it was February 18th or 19th, when this was supposed to go into effect, because they didn't want their children to be stateless. They didn't want their babies to be deported or deportable, right? Yeah. So imagine that. Nearly a third of Asian Americans are the U.S. born children of immigrant parents.
Wow.
So like I said, my own sisters, right? When they were born, my parents had a green card. They were not yet U.S. citizens.
Yeah.
Right. But they've been able to enjoy all the rights and privileges of U.S. citizenship. And so, you know, it's really, really important, I think, to understand that impact and to know, as you so rightfully said, that you can't go state to state and have a different set of rights and privileges.
Right.
And so while, you know, as a lawyer, I know that there are questions about individual judges being able to put forth nationwide bans that happened under the Biden administration as well with, you know, medications for abortion and birth right. control, where one single judge wanted to prevent those from being accessed by women. And that was abhorrent. I hope that the Supreme Court will make the right decision here and understand how significant the implications are. That, yes, there are those questions. I think, mm-hmm. you know, one of the attorneys also mentioned there could be a middle path given the significance of birthright citizenship, which is to, you know, have a cautionary note, perhaps a yellow light for most nationwide injunctions. But in this case, to give it a green light, given how significant it would be to force thousands upon thousands of children and families to have a different status, secondary status, based on where they live.
Yeah. And I, listen, the issue of nationwide injunctions is an important one. That is one that crosses ideological lines as well. And I think, and I've written columns saying that Congress needs to address this. We need some rules on the road for that, because in some cases, clearly they are out of line. And I think the Mifepristone case that you brought up is a good example of that. You had one judge in Amarillo, Texas, trying to revoke FDA approval of a drug. Like, there is no universe where that makes any sense, regardless of where what you think about abortion. But then you have, in another case, the like this one, a policy that can really upend the lives of countless people if they themselves do not either sue on their own behalf, or their parents sue on their behalf, or they find a way to become a part of a class action, which, you know, as a former litigator, getting a class action together is so difficult, so time consuming, that that would really be a major, major impediment to this. So the fact, there's a reason why the government kind of tried to hang the case on the injunction thing while sort of trying to say, no, court, don't decide the constitutionality yet, because they want to, I believe, as Justice Kagan pointed out, if they do it that way, they can try to stop, you know, they can allow this executive order to go into effect for some people, giving the administration a win, right? They're implementing this thing while still losing in lower court because this executive order does not seem constitutional at all. But then once all those challenges are done, if they keep losing, it's not like the government's going to go to the Supreme Court to try to get, you know, a result on the constitutional question, because they know they'll lose it. So this is sort of like a too cute by half method for the administration to try to, you know, implement this in as much as they can, knowing that judges, you know, all uniformly across the board have been striking it down. But I want to back up a little bit to a point that you were making that I think is so important, because we are talking about AAPI Americans in this. It's in no way to mean that there is any difference or greater threat to them, or they are bigger stakeholders than other people. The people that are primarily the target of this executive order are people primarily from countries to our south, who the president has previously described as criminals and rapists and not the best. This is from a president who has declared, when speaking of Haiti, for example, that it was an expletive country, and why can't we get more immigrants from places like Norway? this is really a hateful, dare I say, racist policy. And I don't, does the president have AAPI people front of mind in this? I don't know. Maybe not. But the impact on this to members of all of our communities, we're talking about all of our neighbors, people who go to our churches, people who are a part of our communities, people who sit next to our kids in schools. The impact of this would be so broad reaching that I'm glad that you are pointing out that. And it, in cases like yours with your parents, we are not talking about people. A lot of people have responded into comments on social media to me saying, listen, I don't want passport, you know, citizenship. A person should not just set foot, give birth, and then automatically get an American baby, this, that, and the other. That's a policy issue. If you think that should be the rule, then initiate a constitutional amendment process to change the rules. But what we have been practicing as Americans for over a century, for generations and generations, is not that. It is not that. In the case of your family, these are people who were working, who were professionals, who were intending to build a life here, as were Wong Kim Ark's parents. They were intended to build a life in California, but they couldn't because federal law prevented them from doing that. And so they returned to China. This is not about people trying to scam the system. The number of people trying to do that, I would hazard, is percentage-wise very small, right?
Right. No, and that's such a perfect point. The individuals we're talking about, the families, they want to contribute. And they do contribute. They contribute through their tax dollars. They contribute through their hard work and everything that's produced, from the individual who delivers your food through DoorDash, to the teacher at your school, to the tech executives in Silicon Valley. So many of the individuals who contribute to our GDP, who contribute to our communities, are themselves immigrants, they're former immigrants. And frankly, without immigrants, we would be in a sorryful situation. We wouldn't have enough people to do the work needed, right? We wouldn't have the individuals to pick our fruits and vegetables. We wouldn't have the individuals to work in our hospitals and take care of us. So that's the thing that I think anti-immigrant folks fail to understand, is that immigration benefits the U.S. and immigrants from all over the world benefit our country tremendously. And so that's why it's really important today, even though this may be about the nationwide injunction, to remember that this is actually much broader. And it's about how we think of ourselves as a nation and how our current president and his administration are trying to reshape that. In poll after poll, Americans have said in recent weeks, they are against this. They are against mass deportations. They are against sending people to concentration camps. They are against getting rid of due process and habeas corpus. And they are for birthright citizenship.
Yes. You know, I am so glad that you bring that up, because I want to finish our discussion. I watched your TED Talk that you did not too long ago, where you were talking about your story and your family, and you centered it on the idea of radical healing. Can you say a little bit about that to close out this discussion?
Sure. And thank you so much for raising that. So radical healing is actually a pretty new framework. It was designed by African American scholars in the field of psychology. And they said, you know, it's not enough just for us to heal individually, right? When we've been impacted by the trauma of racism, right? It's a horrible thing, and people should seek mental health services for it. but we also need to change the conditions under which we live so it doesn't happen to the next person, right? So I think of, you know, young African-American men who might be on the receiving end of police violence, right? I can't imagine how traumatic that is. And certainly they should receive help. But what they should also do is be able to be civically engaged, to advocate for policies so that this doesn't happen to the next generation of young Black men. And my parents did that themselves. And that's why I interwove their story, which is, you know, they were taught, like so many other immigrants, keep your head down and work hard. And they did work hard. And when my mom went in for an interview to join a family practice group, she was asked one question: why do you foreigners come to the US and take all of our jobs? So it was never about her qualifications. It was about a vendetta. It was about exerting the racist muscle against her. So she didn't stay quiet. She and my dad brought what ended up being a class action lawsuit, and which was actually settled within a year or two because it was so clear how wrong their actions were. And it actually led to thousands of doctors of color across the state of Alabama also getting the opportunity to share their talents and skills with their patients. And so I'm so proud of that story, and that's why I told it.
Well, I will leave a link to that talk in the show notes here. And I am grateful to your parents, and I am grateful to you for joining me. Manju Kulkarni, thank you so much for joining me today on Justice by Design.
Thank you so much for having me. Real honor and privilege.
And thanks to all the listeners for listening to this podcast episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. Also, check out the video on YouTube. And don't forget to give us 5 stars because that helps other people find the podcast. I will see you next week with another episode of Justice by Design. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store.